say the hungry should have food. I speak for many when I say no one should have seven homes. While some don't have any, though I may find myself stranded in some strange place with naught but a vapid stare, I remember the world and I know we are everywhere. I say the time for the rich, it will come. Let me count the ways, victories or hints of the future. Havana, Caracas, Chiapas, Buenos Aires. How many people are wanting and waiting and fighting for their share? They hide in their ivory towers, but we are everywhere. Religions and prisons and races, borders and nations, FBI agents and congressmen and corporate radio stations. They try to keep us apart, but we find each other, and the rulers are always aware that they're a tiny minority, and we are everywhere. With every bomb that they drop, every home they destroy, every land they invade, comes a new generation from under the rubble saying, we are not afraid. They will pretend we are few, but with each child that a billion mothers bear, comes the next demonstration that we are everywhere. We are everywhere.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is Searching for the Meaning of the Holocaust. Elie Wiesel was 15 when he was deported by the Nazis along with his family from their home in Transylvania to the Auschwitz concentration camp. Elie lost both of his parents and younger sister in the Holocaust, and he made it his life's long goal to teach the world about the Holocaust. The prize-winning author of more than 40 works of fiction and nonfiction tried to capture in his writings the vibrant Jewish world that had existed before the war, in addition to its destruction in the Holocaust. He received the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts. And then after that, Dan McMillan explains the Holocaust. Dan McMillan presents his thoughts from the prevalence of anti-Semitism and political fissures occurring from World War I to Germany's inability to become a democracy to 1918.
Mr. President, Mr. Prime Minister, mes amis de France, Nitzolei Shoah Yekarim. As you walk through the museum, so magnificently conceived by Moshe Safdie, you wonder, where is the place of rage in all that? How come that the Jewish people, when we discovered the magnitude of cruelty and the consequences of hatred, how come that we were not possessed by an extraordinary, implacable rage, rage of the killers? Rage toward those who inspired the killers. Rage towards the indifferent, those who knew and were silent. Where is rage? So you look and you look, and you are afraid to look. I am. I look at some pictures of Jews from Hungary, and I'm afraid to discover some that I have known. You read, and you read, and you say to yourself, where did they have the strength to write, to use words? Destined to whom? My good friends, all of us know, more or less, that there was a tragedy. And we also know, we must be honest about it, there are no words. Only those who were there know what it meant being there. And yet, we are duty-bound to try and not to bury our memories into silence. We try. I know what people say. It's so easy. Those that were there won't agree with that statement. The statement is, it was man's inhumanity to man. No. It was man's inhumanity to Jews. Jews were not killed because they were human beings. In the eyes of the killers, they were not human beings. They were Jews. It is because they were Jews that it was so easy for the killers to kill. And you see the pictures. My God, you see the pictures. Jews were ordered to dig their own graves. Have we ever had that in history, which always is filled with cruelty, but not such cruelty? Have mothers ever been forced to give up their children in order to live, and few mothers chose that? No. Mothers went with their children, with their babies. There are no words. At that time, we had a feeling that history had entered into madness, and madness had its own logic, its own destiny, almost its own archaeology. And within that madness, it was perfectly plausible to kill children. And so we go through the museum and we don't understand. All we know is that it happened. And now the question is, what does one do with memories? Any psychiatrist will tell you, if you suppress memories, they come back with fury. We must face them. Even if we cannot articulate them, we must face them. And memories are many and varied. Memories of those who died with weapons in their hands, and those who died with prayers on their lips. And let no one say that some were heroes and others martyrs. In those times, the heroes were martyrs, and the martyrs were heroes. It was heroic for a friend to give his piece of bread to his friend. It was heroic to go around on Shabbat and simply say to his or her friends, it's Shabbat today. It was heroic to have faith. It was heroic to be human. And so we go through the museum. And what should we do? Weep? No. My good friends, we never try to tell the tale to make people weep. It's too easy. We didn't want pity. If we decided to tell the tale, it is because we wanted the world to be a better world. Just a better world. And learn and remember. There is a frightening character in all of Kafka's stories. It's always the messenger who tried to deliver the message and is unable to do so. We feel sorry for him, poor messenger. But there is something more tragic than that. When the messenger has delivered the message and nothing has changed. You heard tonight those who spoke here with elegance, with compassion. And they spoke already about anti-Semitism and intolerance. Now, 60 years later, when the messenger has tried to deliver the message, why should there be anti-Semitism? But there is. Why should there be suicide killers? But there are. Why should there be hatred? But there is. Fanaticism, yes, it's gone. No, it's here. The messenger has delivered the message. What is our role? We must become the messenger's messengers.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
We gotta rise up, rise up, rise up. Say it's to protect you while they try to dispossess you of the right to decide between wrong or right, to openly discuss what politicians hide. They want to keep their secret plans from the public eye. We gotta keep our fire burning, keep our spirits bright. We gotta rise up, rise up, rise up. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people. Money got no children, and bombs ain't for building. Killing ain't no way to make a peaceful day, as all of God's children can easily explain. We gotta keep our fires burning, keep our spirits bright. Stand up and speak for what we know is right. We gotta rise up, rise up, rise up. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people. Days ahead, kiss my children into bed. All across the planet I see that everything is fine. Yeah. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people. We got the power and the will, and we'll do it for our children. Put the warmongers and the corporate whores in the history books with the dinosaurs. I claim my power, I claim my rights, and no dirty tricks are gonna change my mind. I'm gonna rise up, rise up, rise up. Rise up, rise up, rise up. Rise up, people, against the war. 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 Rise up.
Coming up next, Dan McMillan tries to explain the Holocaust.
Thank you very much for being here. The Holocaust has been with me for a long time now. And in my experience, it affects us in a way that is qualitatively different from how we respond to contemplating other historical events. When we look at all of the terrible suffering that human beings have inflicted on each other down through the centuries, we are often saddened by what we see, and sometimes It is good we are also angry. When we look at the Holocaust, we're frightened. The Holocaust frightens people. Why is that? What is different? What is special? What is perhaps unique about the Holocaust? Today I'll offer you an answer to that question. I'll talk first for 5 minutes about my book, what is new about this book, and why I think you may find it useful. Then I'll take 15 minutes to summarize the central argument of my book, which is my explanation, my answer to the question, why did the Holocaust happen? And then for the last 12 minutes of my remarks, I'll return to the question, in what sense may we consider the Holocaust to be unique, to be in a category by itself, not only among episodes of genocide, but among all historical occurrences, as in fact I think it is. As the title of my book implies, it's an attempt to explain why the Holocaust happened. Up till now, we have gotten only rather partial answers to this question. The closest that we've come to, in books and print to an answer have been the histories of the Holocaust, the narrative accounts. And these suffer from the defect that they, with regard to explanation of the event, they focus almost entirely on the immediate sort of short-term causes of the genocide. That is to say, what did Adolf Hitler believe about the Jewish people, and what were the situational pressures or the context that encouraged Hitler to radicalize his policy from discrimination in 1933 to forced emigration by 1938 to full-blown genocide by the end of 1941. And these short-term factors are essential, of course, to understanding this event, but by themselves they are completely inadequate as an answer to the question why, because they only beg so many other larger and important questions. For example, where did Hitler get his ideas in the first place? And even more interesting, how is it possible that the educated elite of one of our most advanced societies would take these ideas seriously to the point of being willing to kill for them? And what went wrong in the long-term political development of Germany that a man like Adolf Hitler could come to power in the first place? And how do we understand the attitude of tens of millions of Germans who did have substantial knowledge of the killings while they were happening, and yet who seemed to have responded to the fate of their Jewish neighbors with cold indifference? And about 8 or 10 other questions that you'd need to answer if you wanted to put together a coherent and reasonably comprehensive and satisfactory answer to your question why. Now, this is not to say that historians over the last 7 decades have been idle. Quite the contrary. Historians have, in fact, adequately answered all of the many specific, narrower sub-questions that together make up the larger question, why? But they have done so, by and large, in specialized academic studies, each examining this or that cause of the Holocaust, by and large, in isolation from the others. And thus we have books on Hitler, books on World War I, books on anti-Semitism, books on psychological factors, books on 19th century German politics and the failure of democracy in Germany, and so on and so on and so on. But no book has put all these different pieces of the puzzle together in a coherent whole. To put it another way, the historical profession, and already long ago, at least 20 years ago, adequately answered the question, why did the Holocaust happen? But the answer they have given us has been useless to us because it has been available to us only in fragments, not in a coherent whole. And particularly if you are not an academically trained historian, that is to say, if you're normal, like everyone, and where are you going to start? How are you going to know how to put these different pieces of the puzzle, all these different scholarly studies, together in some kind of explanation? And even if you are a professional historian, it isn't immediately and intuitively obvious what the proper relationship is between the different causes of the Holocaust. So this is what my book does. It just unites the fragments. It's important, I think, because it's the first book to weave together all of the major sort of strands of causation, all the most important pieces of the puzzle in a coherent and reasonably comprehensive answer to the question that all of us have asked. Why did this happen? So, that being said, why did the Holocaust happen? It happened in significant part because the pressure for democracy in Germany from the 1880s on, which was considerable coming from the German people, the pressure to transform the imperial political system, which was authoritarian, into a parliamentary democracy, such as people lived under in France or England at the same time, unfortunately, this pressure came almost entirely from one political party, and this political party was the Socialist Party of Germany. And this was very, very unfortunate because it meant from the outset that for most Germans, the idea of democracy was tainted by association with socialism. And this taint was a very heavy taint indeed, because The Socialist Party in Germany, at least in its rhetoric, in its formally stated program, was quite radical. They called for revolution. They called for an end to the capitalist system. They called for an end to private property. And for almost everyone in Germany outside of the industrial working class, which was the base, the constituency of the Socialist Party, the Socialists were terrifying. Compounding this problem in its impact was a second issue, and that is that democracy simply came to Germany very late. The first German democracy, the Weimar Republic, was not founded until 1919, after a revolution that followed, that came in the closing days of the First World War. These two factors in combination, the linkage between socialism and democracy, and the late arrival of the democratic form of government to German soil, had the effect that from the very beginning of the Republic, a very large fraction of the electorate was out and out hostile to the Republic and to democracy because they equated it, naturally enough, with socialism. And making the problem even worse, the Republic being founded so late, or to put it another way, so close in time to the Great Depression, had no time, had no breathing space, no period of stability and prosperity in which you could win over these hostile voters and establish its legitimacy among the German people, as any new form of government must, among its citizens. The Republic had almost barely been founded in 1919 when, after 1929, it was overwhelmed by the Great Depression, which also struck Germany with exceptional fury. So, in the end game, you have an electorate that very large part of which is hostile to democracy, a very large other fraction is indifferent to democracy, and people who are absolutely desperate amid economic chaos like nothing they have ever seen. And in those circumstances and armed with those attitudes, a majority of German voters in the last elections of 1932 gave their ballots to extremist political parties that were violently anti-democratic, the communists on the left, the Nazis on the right. And this is a very large, this takes us a long way to understanding how a man like Hitler could come to power in Germany, whereas in our country he would have had no chance at all, because in our country the idea of democracy was already respected and established for over a century before the Great Depression. Democratic form of government, its legitimacy was never in question. This is, I guess, the short answer to the question why, even though the American people and the German people experienced comparable levels of economic suffering in the Great Depression, we ended up with FDR as our political leader, and they got Adolf Hitler. A second sort of cluster of issues is also related to this rapidly rising socialist party, and that is that the elite of German society, this very conservative ruling class, that is to say university-trained professionals, titled aristocrats, owners and managers of large corporations, higher civil servants, military officers, this ruling class of about 500,000 men on the eve of World War I in 1914, pursued a strategy of using nationalism and anti-Semitism as weapons against the rising socialist party. And the way that this effectively worked, the logic of it was, let us try to get Germans to overlook their different class differences, especially the crucial middle, you know, working class versus the rest of society divide, by getting them to unite on the basis of something that supposedly they had in common, their German blood, which was now defined also by the exclusion of Jews, who were then held to be a separate race. And this is incidentally, this what later became the fatal notion that the Jewish people were a race, this is one point at which it entered German political discourse. To put another way, this right-wing strategy was one of saying to Germans, come on, let us not be upper class, and let us not be middle class, and for heaven's sakes, let not be working class, and vote for these nasty socialists and their theory of class struggle. Let us all just be German together. And one way for us all to be German and emphasize our Germanness is to unite against our enemies, against foreign powers who are painted to the German public as being resolutely hostile and a constant military threat, and at home, the Jews, who are blamed for fostering the divisions in German society. And the crucial to this prong of this strategy was the false claim that the Jewish people were the originators of Marxism, that they had created the Socialist Party, that they controlled the Socialist Party, and as this thinking was taken further after the Russian Revolution of 1917, that they controlled and had created the communist parties of the world.
The president came to London, was greeted by the Queen. For the people of the city, it was a festive scene. Hundreds of thousands of women and men were all in the street, shouting and dancing and talking and marching on their feet. But the highest peak of the evening, to be only fair, was when the statue of George Bush was toppled in Trafalgar Square. Those days in London was the place to be. Young and old, black and white, was the face of society. Even the mayor came out, called him a criminal of war. Said world domination ain't worth fighting for. They said we don't like W or his poodle Tony Blair. On the day the statue of George Bush was toppled in Trafalgar Square, the night sky was lit up and the message it was clear. We do not want fascism over there or over here. It was heard firsthand by many right there on British soil. We will not fight for Exxon. We won't kill or die for oil. But for billions around the planet, we were all right there when the statue of George Bush was toppled. Trafalgar Square. When the statue of George Bush was toppled in Trafalgar Square.
And now for something completely different.